mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, once construction of the new Judicial Center is completed downtown, what will become of the current probate court building? Preservation Ohio considers it among Ohio's most endangered historic sites. Also this morning, we've come to rely on them to manage our personal finances, which means they store volumes of valuable data that hackers would love to get their hands on. So how secure are those mobile banking apps? And they don't call them the dog days for nothing. How to ensure your family pet has a safe and happy summer too. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, May 22nd, 2024. Big news. Out of Toledo, this is from our media partners, WTOL-TV, a report that Alan Block has been fired as chief executive officer of Block Communications. The firing comes 2 weeks after he filed a lawsuit in Lucas County Common Pleas Court against his brother, John Block, and other board members of Block Communications, BCI. He is seeking an injunction to prevent the sale of certain properties owned by Block Communications, which include the Blade newspaper and the cluster of network broadcast TV stations in Lima, as well as Toledo cable and internet provider Buckeye Broadband. Now, I don't know what he believes the sale would include, but sale of any of those properties would be rather significant. Block Communications also owns other newspaper and broadcast entities, but those are the ones that most impact our region. In the injunction request, Alan Block claims that other board members have frozen him out of decisions on the company's future and have not allowed him to be on the special strategic committee which negotiates possible sales. He also said the sale could result in the closure of the Blade. It's been publishing since 1848. Alan Block is asking to be placed on the special strategic committee and that he be given complete access to financial books and records of the company. No hearing dates on the case have been scheduled. But that could be a really interesting development, story that could impact the future of the Toledo Blade newspaper, the TV stations in Lima, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, definitely a story worth watching here this morning. Some of the other most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started. Doctors are sounding the alarm as influencers claim that SPF protection is toxic. So as we get into the summer season where, you know, we're constantly reminded, make sure you wear your sunscreen. We should be doing this all year long, wearing sunscreen, but especially in the summertime when we're showing more skin, we're spending more time outdoors. Now, apparently, some influencers or wannabe medical professionals are claiming in videos on TikTok that sunscreen is toxic. And these videos have been gaining popularity. Here's a spoiler alert. They are not toxic. Some influencers even suggest that by not wearing sunscreen, you actually build up your melanin to handle the sun. You build up an immunity to the sun. And sunscreen prevents that from happening. No, that's not true. Dr. Bav Shergill says it is a common misconception that you can build up a base tan, which will protect you from damage from the sun. But that is not the case. If you don't want to use sunscreen, you really need to be on top of other forms of sun protection, which include limiting your time in the sun, getting into the shade, wearing clothing that covers the skin. Another doctor, Richard Parsons, warns that sunburns raise cancer risk and premature aging of the skin, but the cancer risk is the big thing. And these influencers are saying that the sunscreen is actually what is toxic. No. Now, That being said, is there some risk in applying sunscreen, which basically most sunscreens involve a chemical compound that is absorbed into the skin, which in turn absorbs the harmful rays of the sun? And yeah, I guess there would be some sort of risk to putting a chemical compound on your body that is absorbed into the skin, but it is minute as compared to the danger of skin cancer. So the long and short of it is, don't believe everything that you see on TikTok. That's basically the thing. Because you definitely need to wear sunscreen, no matter what you see on TikTok. But apparently these things are gaining steam. It's just bizarre to me. But anyway, there's a couple of other items here among the first things you need to know this morning. The world's largest tree might be sick. The General Sherman stands 275 feet tall in the giant sequoia forest in California. It just so happens that wildfire passed through the grove of giant trees in 2021. You remember when that was a big story in the news. And now the bark beetle has arrived, posing a serious threat to the General Sherman and many of the other trees. Researchers have found several nearby trees infested with the pests, and some of those trees are now dying, and scientists are studying the General Sherman, which is the tallest tree in the world, the largest tree, to look for signs of bark beetles. If they find them, they say it may be too late to save the tree because there is no known way to eradicate the insects without irreparably harming the tree. 275 feet tall, 36 and a half foot diameter at its base. That is, wow. So that would really be a shame if the tree were to die. But big news. And speaking of dying and doom and gloom stories, definitely want to share this with you this morning because it is very important. Researchers in Southern California are predicting doom if and when a massive glacier in Antarctica breaks off. Scientists at the University of California, Irvine, discovered that warming ocean waters are rushing underneath a group of large glaciers, including the enormous Thwaites Glacier, which is sometimes called the Doomsday Glacier. The warmer water has made its way miles underneath the frozen ice, and researchers say it is only a matter of time before the Doomsday Glacier breaks off. And if it does, it could rise sea levels. Now, mind you, they say if sea levels rise even an inch, coastal communities could be inundated with water. And they say that the Doomsday Glacier is large enough to raise global sea levels by 2 feet. Even 1 inch would threaten coastal communities. This could rise global sea levels by 2 feet, which would cause catastrophic results around the world. So, happy Wednesday. Long and short of it is, we're all going to die. That's what it is. We're all going to die. So, just important stuff to start your day with. That's what you want to hear when you first wake up, right? We're all going to die. And finally, among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, despite the fact that the Doomsday Glacier might devastate coastal communities, including the vast majority of the state of Florida, the best place to live in the U.S. is Naples on Florida's southwest Gulf Coast. This is according to the latest U.S. News and World Report ranking. The best places to live in the country. Naples, Florida is number one, according to U.S. News and World Report. This is an annual best places to live list. The report considers several factors, including affordability, quality of life, job market, and desirability. Naples, number one. Know what number two was? Boise, Idaho. Now, those are two completely different cities, right? Naples, Florida to Boise, Idaho. But Boise was number two. Colorado Springs, Colorado, number three. Greenville, South Carolina, and Charlotte, North Carolina, round out the top five. In case you're curious, Columbus was the top-rated Ohio city on the list, coming in at number 61 overall. So, the best places to live. But then, of course, I'm guessing that if the Doomsday Glacier breaks off, then they will adjust the list. I'm thinking they might have to. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Partly cloudy today, a chance of a few storms, a high around 80. Partly cloudy tonight, low around 60. A temporary FEMA disaster recovery center is open in Findlay to help Hancock County residents in their recovery from the March 14th tornadoes. On that date, an EF1 tornado touched down in southwest Hancock County, destroying Rick Marshall's barn and damaging his house.
We were in the basement. Everybody walked out just fine. You know, house can be repaired. Barn can be replaced. Our family's fine, and God watched over us.
Specialists from FEMA and the U.S. Small Business Administration will be at the center to help people apply for federal disaster assistance and answer other questions that people might have. The temporary center is located at the Hancock County Engineer's Office at 1900 Lima Avenue in Findlay. Bowling Green State University is mourning the loss of a member of their Athletics Hall of Fame and someone who helped defeat the Russians in 1980.
Mark Wells, who was a star forward for the BGSU Falcons hockey team in the 1970s and who went on to play in the Olympics, has died at the age of 66. Wells was on the gold medal Olympic hockey team, which famously beat the Russians in Lake Placid in 1980, a game affectionately described as the miracle on ice.
ONN's Kate Burdett reporting. The Ohio Department of Natural Resources Division of Wildlife says 27 white-tailed deer tested positive for chronic wasting disease in the 2023-24 deer hunting season, with 21 of the positive samples in Wyandotte County. CWD is a fatal neurological disease that affects white-tailed deer and other similar species. Get more in the story on our website. The Findlay-Hancock County Community Foundation says Findlay City Schools received a grant totaling $30,000 to install book vending machines at their primary and intermediate schools. The book vending machines are used as an incentive for students to demonstrate leadership qualities and achieve their goals. See a picture of a Northview student excited to receive their first book from the vending machine in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, it won't be too many more weeks before some very difficult questions are going to have to be asked and answered for the community. Once construction of the new judicial center is completed downtown, what will become of the current probate court building? Preservation Ohio considers it among Ohio's most endangered historic sites, and Executive Director Thomas Palmer joins us now. Thomas, this is an annual list you put out of these most endangered historic sites. Explain the purpose of this list.
Well, Chris, the point of the list is to focus attention on properties which have first been nominated to Preservation Ohio and then reviewed and then selected as being among those properties in the state which meet certain criteria, primarily that they are endangered through a variety of means, and that in addition to that, they have significance to the local communities and or to the state of Ohio as a whole. And they're compared one against the other, and then we come up with our list, which we issue in May, which is National Preservation Month each year.
Now, I was going to ask, how do you determine what sites get on the list? I mean, you alluded to that, but there are lots of old buildings in Ohio. They can't all be preserved. One could even say that some of them shouldn't be. So how do you determine which ones have actual historical significance and future value?
Well, Chris, I couldn't agree with you more. Not all can or should be preserved, but there are many that do have the ability to provide character and a sense of context for communities as they move forward into the future. And what we do is we solicit nominations from local, it can be preservation constituencies, or they can be local governments, mm-hmm. or organizations or whatever. And then we review them for determination of the quality of the site, whether the site has merit, the condition of the site, what kind of a threat there is, and if it's something that can be illustrative of to other communities, and if it's something which is, we feel, an important piece of Ohio history.
Now, it should be noted that inclusion on this list doesn't necessarily carry the same weight as a designation like the National Registry of Historic Places, for example, but you do have a solid track record of fostering successful efforts to save many of the places that have been on the list in the past.
That is absolutely true, Chris. Places like the Athenaeum, which is the old Masonic temple in the middle of downtown Columbus, places like the Westcott House, which is the only Frank Lloyd Wright Prairie-style commission residence constructed in the state of Ohio, and many, many others around the state are all standing in large part because they were placed on the most endangered list. It does serve to highlight and to focus attention that often generates concerted efforts in local communities.
So the idea is to call attention to the significance and highlight the potential. Is this something that you work with the current owners of a particular site to find viable options or assist in seeking new owners who could see the potential in saving the building or repurposing a site for another use?
We do work with property owners of most endangered properties. We're working with a small community in Union County right now on a property that was listed on the most endangered sites list, and is now this. We've been working with them. We met with their village council earlier this year, and there is a preservation-focused effort there. So, no, we work with local communities and groups and local governments all the time. Absolutely right that not all of them are saved, but we do have an impact, and we're very committed to that effort.
What are the biggest challenges, generally speaking, when you look at some of these sites? Because in the case of the probate court building, there are, as I look at it, some unique challenges, especially given its location is kind of wedged in there between the municipal building, the courthouse, and what will be the new judicial center. It does kind of, it seems like it would limit what can be done with that structure, given the location, everything that's around it. So what are, I'm just curious, what are some of the biggest challenges that you encounter in, you know, finding ways to save some of these sites?
Well, there's a variety of challenges. Often a challenge is typically focused on generating revenue sufficient to do a renovation job. But in the case of the one in Findlay, what often happens is we go out and find other examples of governmental bodies that have had opportunities like Findlay has and make them aware of that. That's something that we can serve to collect and to share information. That's something we're very interested in doing.
Are there any that immediately come to mind where you've had situations like this in the past? Again, you know, they may or may not be direct parallels, but other examples of buildings like this where they've been municipally owned or county owned, where, you know, there's just not a need anymore. So what do you do with this space next?
Well, like the one I just was referring to, Chris, in Union County, that is municipally owned.
Okay.
And that is a former town hall that did not have a very apparent adaptive reuse opportunity. And so we've been working with them in some ways to get it into private hands so that it can be restored or renovated. So the purpose is to be as creative as possible and to work with local communities, local governments, and get them thinking about alternative ways to achieve ends that can serve the community, serve the needs of the local government, but at the same time can preserve pieces of architecture that, in the case of the one in Findlay, has a strong history in connection to the history of the community, and it's something that would be lost without it. And I can't give you an example right now of exactly what Hancock County could do, but heaven knows other counties have dealt with those things very creatively.
Well, that again is part of the process, and again, we're very early in this. The list has just been released, so is, you know, part of getting the process started is some of that out of the box thinking. I would imagine. I mean, that's really what the purpose of the list is.
You betcha. That's a great way to describe it, Chris.
And at the end of the day, the worst thing would be for it to just sit there unused and not being maintained. I mean, yes, you ultimately want to save it, but you certainly don't want it to become an eyesore.
Absolutely true. There are properties nominated to the list every year that have gone through that process you're talking about now, a process of disinvestment, sitting there for long periods of time. You're right, that is not a win-win solution for anyone. So that's why we're very interested in finding any way possible to make investment the best option.
And getting that on the list now before it gets into that type of a situation. Again, Executive Director Thomas Palmer with Preservation Ohio. Again, the what is now the Hancock County Probate Court building is on their latest list of Ohio's most endangered historic sites. And folks can get more information about that and other sites that are on the list and some of what Preservation Ohio has done to preserve this history elsewhere across the state at your website, correct?
Absolutely. PreserveOhio.com. Please visit the site. You can read all about it. You can find lists from the last 10 years, and you can see what properties have been on there. And it's a treasure trove of information.
Thomas, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
You betcha, Chris. Take care.
Well, thanks to today's technology, managing your money has certainly never been easier. First, through web-based platforms, now mobile apps, you can do all your banking on your device, but should you? Those apps store a lot of sensitive data, and data security is a growing concern as the technology becomes more and more sophisticated. CNET Money editor Dacia Milden recently did a deep dive into the security of these apps and the methods that hackers try to use to bypass those security measures. And Dacia, banks stress that they have world-class security protocols, the best in the world, but do they really?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Chris. I think the number one thing that you always want to make sure that you're doing is making sure that you're keeping that app up to date. So there are a lot of new security features that banks will roll out with those app updates that we often, you know, may hold off on doing or may not think is important. But a lot of those apps actually do have the security measures that are more up to speed and up to date that can really protect our information. So can't get into details on exactly what each bank is offering, but definitely want to make sure that if you want to stay up to speed and keep your information secure, the banking features and security features that they're offering those banks, you got to make sure that you keep that app updated.
And by the way, when we talk about money management apps, that really encompasses more than just your bank, right? I mean, it could be your credit card company, your investment broker. There are those budgeting apps like Credit Karma. I'm guessing, you know, are they all created equal? Are they all kind of on the same level security-wise from what your research tells you?
Right. Yeah. It all depends on the bank. So when we think about it, most banks offer that biometric authentication, right? So with your face ID or that fingerprint, some of them offer end-to-end encryption. Others may offer the ability to change your password every so often, right? Or suggest that you do. So while every bank offers different security features, the goal is still the same, making sure that that app is updated, making sure that, you know, you're following the basic online safety measures, even when using those apps. That's more of the more important piece. Even if all the, you know, your credit card company versus your bank, just making sure that you are enabling all of those safety features. That's the more important piece. So for example, while one bank may offer two-factor authentication where you log in, but then you still have to get that text message sent to your phone.
Right.
While one bank may offer that, your credit card company might not, or you may not have it enabled. So just making sure that you're going through and checking to see what's available, and even just calling your bank or even calling your credit card company to get an understanding of what those features are, that can be a big help too.
Now, when this all first became a thing, the big banks, the big financial institutions were the ones that jumped on this right away, which makes sense because they have the most resources to be able to develop these apps, your Chases and Bank of America and so on. These days, you've got even smaller regional banks, local banks, credit unions or so and so on that have, at a very minimum, web platforms where you can do your banking. Again, does size matter in all of this, or are they pretty much the same level of security industry-wide?
I think it varies from bank to bank. You may find that there are credit unions that have the same, if not even better, features in terms of security, depending on where you bank. It really goes back to making sure that when you are going through and choosing your bank or deciding whether or not you're going to stick with that online banking, just double checking to see what features are available, because you might actually be surprised. I've seen, as of lately, there are some credit unions even near me that have really good banking features and security features that protect information. And they're just as helpful as, you know, those bigger banks that we talk about. So more importantly, making sure that you're seeing what is available so that you know what you're comfortable with, and even seeing what you can do to protect your information a little bit more.
The bottom line is that nothing is hack-proof at the end of the day. I mean, just like the security protocols are constantly advancing, they have to, because the hackers are advancing their skills as well. So in that sense, one might ask, are the advantages of using these apps really worth it if we can't be 100% sure?
I think the main thing that we can do, even if we're not 100% sure, is making sure that we are taking every measure that is possible and preparing for that worst case scenario. So in the meantime, what you can do is make sure that you're checking up on your information, that those bank statements add up to everything that they should, making sure that you feel comfortable. If you want to maybe handle some services in person, just for your own, you know, peace of mind, that is an option. But if you are looking for making sure that, hey, I do want to use this app, just making sure that you understand what security measures are available and preparing in the meantime, just in case something does happen, maybe making sure that you call your bank, looking at those bank statements, reviewing your information, changing your password every so often, just making sure that you keep a close eye on everything, regardless of whether you're banking in person or over the phone or using your app. You always want to make sure that you're keeping a close eye on exactly what is going on with your accounts and your information.
You bring up No, I was going to say, you bring up a really good point, especially, and I'm guilty of this too, because we get all of these notifications and, you know, we have the apps to help us track our money. Sometimes that can lull us into a false sense of security that we don't always check our statements the way we should, or, you know, keep track of this on a daily or weekly basis the way maybe we used to before the advent of all of this technology.
Right. Yeah. It's one of those things where if you just keep a close eye on it, that way you can catch it, flag it, alert your bank, do whatever you need to make sure that, you know, you're safeguarding your information and you're taking those steps as soon as possible instead of, you know, 3 to 6 months from now.
Yeah. And honestly, that's one of the advantages to the apps themselves, that if something does happen, if something seems amiss, you know, it's that instant information that you can get your hands on to, you know, rectify the situation before it becomes a larger problem.
Right. 100% agree there.
So again, CNET Money Editor Dacia Milden is with us talking about the security of banking and financial services apps, given the fact that so much of our sensitive personal information is out there with those apps or being stored on those apps and on those online platforms. Dacia Milden, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
You're listening to Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
A man wanted for his suspected involvement in a shooting in Escambia County, Florida, which is the Pensacola area. Was found by police inside of a clothes dryer, neatly folded. This is the story. David Jerome Jackson has been a person of interest since the incident happened back in March. They've been looking for him. A tip recently sent officers to a home on Edgewater Drive, I believe in Pensacola there, right? In any event, the tip sent officers to the home. After an extensive search, deputies proceeded to the laundry room where they finally discovered Mr. Jackson folded not so neatly inside a remarkably small dryer drum, according to a report from the sheriff's office. The look on his face, a combination of guilt, embarrassment, and warm hosiery, according to the sheriff's department statement. Mr. Jackson was pulled out one limb at a time and taken into custody. Hiding in the dryer. They'll never find me. They'll never find me here. It's crazy. Elsewhere in the broken news, if you have ever been involved in settling up the estate of a loved one, you know that it can sometimes get messy. Frederick Ward Sr. passed away in 2020 and had limited contact with his five grandchildren while he was alive. But that didn't stop his granddaughters from initiating a fight over their grandfather's will. Apparently, they were upset that they received only about $60 apiece. By the way, this is happening in the UK. This is the international file of the UK. Each of the five granddaughters got about $60 apiece. Not only did a high court in the UK throw out their claim to set aside the will, but the five grandchildren, now, because of this prolonged legal fight over their grandfather's estate, now the five grandchildren owe over $200,000 in legal fees. $200,000 in legal fees that you racked up contesting a $60 inheritance. By the way, Mr. Ward had a much larger estate than, you know, $300 or whatever it was that he left to his grandkids. The majority of his estate were left to his children. And the grandkids were not happy about that, so they sued. They lost. And now they're even further behind. That does seem like some level of poetic justice there, doesn't it? Let's see. Back on this side of the pond, police in Portland, Oregon arrested a man last week for allegedly carrying a cache of weapons in a guitar case. But what was really bizarre about this story, odd about this story, was how they got their man. Police stopped and questioned Mr. Layton Clark when officers saw him carrying a machete. They also saw a shotgun barrel sticking out of the guitar case, and that looked a little suspicious. It was the barrel of a shotgun poking out of the guitar case. When they asked Mr. Clark to open the case, they found a pump-action shotgun, a handgun, a second machete, a hatchet, and a pocket knife. He was booked into jail on several weapons charges. I would think so. Let's see. And a couple of other items in the broken news here. Now this, it's college graduation season. A lot of college kids getting their diplomas, heading out into the real world. And, you know, you wonder, will they be able to make it? Well, this guy is going to be able to make it. Alex Eisler is his name. He has a degree in programming. He's a computer programmer. And he has discovered a way to flip restaurant reservations. He flips restaurant reservations. He has created a platform that will secure reservations at popular restaurants and then sell the reservations to the highest bidder. Whoa! What an idea! His largest sale so far was over $1,300 for a reservation to a Japanese restaurant that apparently, and I'm not sure where this restaurant is, but apparently it's very good, very hard to get into. He nabbed reservations, and so he sold them online, turned around and flipped his reservations. Somebody paid him over $1,300 for his reservations. To date, he has made a little over $100,000 from his idea, while the Better Online Ticket Sales Act reduces the use of automated bots to buy event tickets, like concert tickets, sporting events, and then resell them for a profit. The law was changed to disallow that. It is unclear whether the act actually applies to restaurant reservations, because it doesn't spell that out specifically. And so he's created the platform and making money off $100,000 flipping restaurant reservations. That actually is brilliant. That's one of those things. Man, I wish I'd have thought of that. That is awesome. Well, there you go. And finally, in the broken news this morning, a story of poetic justice. They say that big things come in small packages, but a 10-foot-wide house in Jacksonville Beach is selling for $619,000. 10 foot wide, this house is. Just 10 feet wide, $619,000. It's nicknamed the Skinny House, and it features 2 bedrooms, 3 bathrooms, and over 1,500 square feet of living space. And if you're wondering how in the world did they squeeze 1,500 square feet of living space into a 10-foot wide house, that's because it is 140 feet long. So here's the story, if you're wondering what inspired this unique piece of real estate. It was basically built out of spite. John Atkins and Ryan Weatherhold of Oceanside Real Estate had originally planned on building a 15-foot wide house, but caught flack from the neighbors on either side because local building codes require that homes have to have 7.5 feet of space on either side. And after failing to get a waiver, get an exemption, the developers settled for 10 feet. Now, ordinarily, 10 feet wide for a house would be, you know, way far too skinny. It wouldn't work. And that's what the neighbors were counting on. They didn't want the house built at all. But the lot was 140 foot deep. And so that's what they built. 10 foot wide, 140 feet deep. And if you're wondering how this skinny house is doing on the market, thanks to social media buzz, pretty well. Mr. Atkins says normally you'd get about 50 views in the first few days once the listing was posted. And this one has already had upwards of 2,000 views in the first few days. In fact, they already have a buyer under contract, but they are accepting backup offers just in case. That's a way, even with the neighbors who didn't want the thing built, we'll figure out a way. Where there's a will, there's a way. 10 foot long, 10 foot wide, 140 feet long. I don't know. I don't know if I'd want it for $600,000. It is on the beach, though, in Florida. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
This Memorial Day, as we remember those who have served and sacrificed on behalf of America, we invite you to join us for a Fox News Radio special, Remembering Our Fallen Heroes. Fox News Headlines anchor Tom Graham, a veteran himself, will speak to four members of the extended Fox family who have served in the military about what Memorial Day means to them, what the military should mean to all of us, and how the service of our troops benefits us all.
Saturday at noon on WFIN and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. We're getting closer to Memorial Day weekend, of course, the unofficial beginning of the summer travel season, and a new survey suggests that people are ready to splurge on their getaways this year. It is the 16th annual Vacation Confidence Survey conducted by Allianz Partners USA, which is the vacation insurance company, Allianz Insurance. The survey finds that Americans are expected to spend more than $221.6 billion on vacations this summer. $221.6 billion. Now, they define a vacation as a leisure trip lasting at least a week to somewhere at least 100 miles from home. So if you count quick weekend, extended weekend getaways like Memorial Day weekend, get away for 3 or 4 days and maybe go 50 miles from home, that wouldn't be a vacation necessarily, but that also is travel spending. So it's likely to be far more than $221.6 billion. All of this means that Americans are dipping into their wallets more than last year, with spending up 3.5% from last summer and up 118% from the pre-pandemic summer of 2019. So not only are we back to where we were pre-pandemic, but we have far exceeded the amount we spent on vacations before all of that kind of altered our perspectives. Up 118% from 2019. Now, some of that is because prices are just more expensive than they were, 5 or 6 years ago. But the survey finds that 61% of Americans are planning to travel this year, with the average household spending $2,843 on a summer vacation. That is the fifth time in the survey's history that summer vacations have passed the $2,000 mark. This year's household vacation spending is only slightly more than last year, up about $13, although, again, it is more than $800 more than the summer of 2019. So, again, it just, I think, demonstrates how the pandemic changed the way we think about getting away from it all. And you talk about focusing more on ourselves and, a reminder of what's really important and all of that. I think that kind of manifests itself in this survey. By the way, when we're talking about travel and tourism, efforts to ramp up tourism in the Buckeye State appear to be paying off. Governor Mike DeWine's office reporting that the state set a new record for visitor spending last year, bringing in about $56 billion. Tourism officials say Ohio had more than 230 million visitors last year, with about 48 million of them staying at least one night overnight. State's tourism industry supported over 435,000 jobs in the Buckeye State last year. Well, summer is right around the corner. Summer season is right around the corner. And as we mentioned, they don't call them the dog days for nothing. To help you ensure that your family pet has a safe and happy summer as well. And Natalie and Jessica are with us here from the Humane Society. With Jack, you brought Jack along, and he's kind of gotten himself tangled in some of the wires here in the studio. That's all right. That's okay. There's nothing that we can't work around. Jack is appears to be a beagle mix.
Yeah, with corgi.
Beagle and corgi.
Yes.
And he is an inquisitive little guy.
Yes, he is.
Just checking everything out. And they're still but incredibly well behaved.
Yeah, he really is a very good boy. Yeah. and he really does not like to potty in his cage, so I don't think he'll be hard to housebreak.
Okay.
He's very sweet. He's an active, active young lad.
Yeah. What really impressed me when we came back from the lobby back here to the studio, opened the door, and he checked with you. He looked at you to make sure it was okay to go. You know, he didn't just jump and run.
Right.
I mean, he seems like he would be real easy to train as to the household protocol,
yes,
shall we
say.
Yes,
I definitely agree with that. And like you witnessed, Chris, and like Jess said, he's very friendly. Mm-hmm. I think he jumped up on you to get a little pet.
But not overly anxious.
No. Yeah. He was like, just like, okay, let me just see, like, gentle. Mm-hmm. He was a gentle,
yes,
gentle guy.
Now, what do we know about Jack? I mean,
he was dumped at one of the parks in town, and a good Samaritan found him and brought him in.
My goodness.
So he's about 2 years old.
Okay.
He's very, very sweet. I think he'd be okay with a really laid-back dog. He doesn't like someone who's consistently in his face.
Okay.
And I'm not sure about cats, but he seems okay with kids. I've seen him with a couple kids, and he's done very well.
Okay. And Jack is up for adoption right now.
Yes.
If you would like to add a four-legged member to your family, what is the process for adopting Jack or any of the animals?
So you and anyone else is more than welcome to stop at the shelter. We are located at 4550 Fostoria Avenue. Mm-hmm. So anytime from Tuesday to Friday, 12 p.m. to 5 p.m.
Okay.
Or Saturdays, 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. So what we would do is just have you interact with the pet. If mm-hmm. you have another dog, you would have to bring your dog in to make sure that they're compatible.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have kids, any other adults, they would also have to come in.
Okay, so everybody in the house, literally everyone in the household.
Yes, everybody except
bring
your
them in,
cat.
make sure that they all get along and they all seem to click together.
Yes.
And then the process, how long does the process take?
It depends. So it's typically fairly easy, fairly mm-hmm. seamless. So let's say you want to spend 1 hour with the pet. Mm-hmm. It'd be like 1 hour and 20 minutes.
Okay.
Like with the pet.
So you'd take Jack home with you that day.
Yes, you could. Awesome. If you do rent, we would just have to check with your landlord to make sure it's okay. Because we don't want you to get
obviously.
The pet home and then have to bring the pet
the
right
goal,
back.
Yeah, the goal is to make sure that you don't see Jack again.
Right.
As much as you love him, you want to find a good home. And Jessica, you mentioned that he was a stray. He was dumped.
Yes.
And unfortunately, that does happen all too often.
Yeah.
One of the things that we wanted to mention, whether it's an animal that is loose, that maybe has been abandoned, or maybe is not in the best living situation, call to the Humane Society is a great place to start.
Oh, yes, definitely. Animal control, if you call animal control directly at 419-423-1664, extension 123, they are the ones to look into any kind of cruelty cases or concerns someone might have for an animal.
Mm-hmm.
The dog warden and his deputy, they really do take their job seriously, and they want to help.
Yeah. And with respect to that, we want to talk about the summertime with the pets. This can be a tough time. We've had some really hot days over the past several days, and I have noticed in being outside in the parks and so on, you know, the dogs love to be outside, but they can really struggle
they
in
can.
This kind of heat.
They can become, like, they can have heat exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important, especially the hot days, get them out early, like early in the morning where mm-hmm. it's not so hot, or later in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they like being outside, and if you let them outside, I'm sure they're going to, like, play and have fun, but sometimes they're not going to tell you that they really need to come inside because they just are having some fun.
Yeah.
So if you do need to take them out midday for, like, their bathroom break, obviously, stay outside with them. Mm-hmm. Just let them use the restroom and then come right back in.
Yeah. Some dogs are better at recognizing that, I think, than other dogs are. I know we have a golden and let her out in the middle of the day, and it doesn't take her very long. She's ready to come come right back in. On the other hand, some dogs that we've had in the past, they'll run around until they literally drop.
Yes. Like right now, I have a small dog. He is a black Pomeranian. And he also knows his little limits. He's like, well, okay, can we actually head back inside?
Yeah.
So he will, like, I don't have to tell him. He's like, like, nosing me, like, come on.
Yeah.
Ready for the air conditioning. Yeah, but you're right, Chris. Like, some of them, just you have lots of dogs do. Some of your dogs act differently. Some love to be outside, and you have to be like, come on.
And some like to lay in the sun and bake themselves.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm like, it is hot. Come in. And they're like, oh, no. 5 more minutes on this side.
For those times when you are going to be out, and really any time that it's sunny and warm, you know, plenty of water and you shade. know, shade and that kind of thing. You know, we don't want to forget about that for our pets.
Absolutely. And if you do have outdoor pets, they need to have access to fresh, clean water. Mm-hmm. And it's not water that has been sitting in the sun that's hot. They need to have access to like a shady spot, shady area. And their shelter can't really be a plastic house that they are going to bake in.
Yeah.
And if you see things like that, you have to call Animal Control, 419-423-1664, extension 123.
Again, as we've mentioned, that's why we bring it up. Because you get those calls this time of year because folks see that. And same thing with dogs in dogs in cars.
Yeah, they've had a couple calls already for dogs in cars.
Yeah.
Don't take your pet with you. Please just keep your pets at home. Even if you're going to be really quick and you keep your car on, the air on, the cars can turn off. Mm-hmm. It gets hot very quickly in there.
Yeah.
So if you do see an animal in a car, please call Animal Control. After hours, you would call the Finley dispatch, depending what city you're in, the dispatch, and then they would get a hold of Animal Control.
Yeah. A couple of other things to keep in mind in the summertime that maybe we don't think of, and I think we've talked about this before, but it serves as a reminder. You're taking the dog for a walk. If you're going to be on the sidewalk, on the street, that kind of thing, they're not wearing shoes.
They are not wearing shoes, no. So it's if you are going to take a walk, you know, don't put them on the black pavement.
Mm-hmm.
I even walk my little dog in the grass on the side. Like if, sometimes dogs don't want to be in the grass. They like the cement. So if you are going to take your pet on a walk, a short walk. That way they don't get overheated. That way their pads don't get burnt. Mm-hmm. Just
Absolutely. He is absolutely adorable. You are such a... Jack is up for adoption right now. And lots of other animals at the shelter as
well. Yes, and you can see them at www.hancockhumanesociety.com or you can stop in the shelter.
All right. We've got the link up for more information at our webpage. Go to goodmornings.net. And again, Natalie and Jessica from the Humane Society here with Jack, who is up for adoption. And ladies, thanks very much for dropping by. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program, of course. Remember, once again, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Visit us online at goodmornings.net. Coming up tomorrow on the program, it is a brain drain buster. It is time to kick off the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library's Summer Read Program. We'll get more details. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. Catch you back here tomorrow.